reluctantly crouched at the starting line. Engines pumping and thumping in time. The green light flashes, the flags go up. Churning and burning, they yearn for the cup. They deftly maneuver and muscle for rank. Fuel burning fast on an empty tank. Reckless and wild, they pour through the turns. Their prowess is potent and secretly stern. As they speed through the finish, the flags go down. The fans get up and they get out of town. The arena is empty, except for one man still driving and striving.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to In the Gravel Trap. I'm your host, Adam Tate, of Tribute Racing, with Joey Barnes of Tribute Racing. We've got Christopher DeHardy of Motorsport.com and Josh Farmer of Motorsport Monday. I'll drop the voice. We're here to talk to you tonight about Pirelli World Challenge, about IndyCar, about Formula One, about NASCAR, about all the latest news in racing. So without further ado, I shall pass it over to Mr. Barnes and we will kick the show off. How's everybody doing tonight?
Well, fantastic, except for that accent.
Right? Oh, my goodness. Oh, man. Oh, man. Adam.
Horse racing.
That's crazy. Oh, we're talking about horsepower. Engine. Pumping, thumping, going the distance, cake. Good stuff. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, we got a fun show in store for you tonight. We're going to actually start off with Mr. Christopher DeHardy. And he's going to lead us with the Pirelli World Challenge, and then we're going to talk a little bit about the Mazda Road to Indy, which is getting ready to have their winter fest here in the next couple of weeks. So without further ado, Mr. DeHardy, you have the floor.
Sweet, I've always loved before. Anyway, so Pirelli World Challenge is getting ready to have their 2015 season opener in early part of March over at Circuit of the Americas in Austin. And apparently they have over 100 cars entered between the GT classes and the touring car classes. There's
wow.
Over 60 cars. There's over 60 cars entered in the GT field, and there's about 40 cars, just over 40 cars entered in the TC field, which TC is TC, TCA, and TCB, while GT is GT, GT Cup, GTS, and actually, let me get the entry list right here in front of me. Let's see. They have GT, GTA, which is GT with the amateur driver, GT Cup, GTS, and then TC, TCA, and TCB. There's 103 cars on the entry list, and it's got to be one of the biggest fields that they've had ever at any Pro World Challenge event. And it's something that I'm looking on my radar at it being a fantastic race weekend. Joey, your thoughts on this?
Joey stepped out for a second, but I'll chime in that any race with over 100 cars is ridiculous if you think about it. Le Mans has 56. Pirelli World Challenge is bringing over 100 Dakota. I think it just shows how they've gone from strength to strength, capitalizing a bit on potential weak spots of the Tudor Championship and the fact that WEC only comes over for, you know, a one and done show every September in Austin. So Pirelli World Challenge is really up to ante, and I'm really excited to see what they do. Joey?
Well, them taking so many teams and so many drivers that raced within the IMSA, I guess, what would you say, under the IMSA banner, between Continental Tire and Tudor and everything else. I'm really intrigued to see, number one of the guys that I really enjoy watching that I've had a chance to watch in the last few years has been Ryan Eversley, and seeing him finally get a chance in a factory team with a new Acura. I'm interested to see that. I'm interested to see where this crossover comes, because we've seen some pretty decent sports car guys move over, to the Pirelli World Challenge. And frankly, I'm wondering this is legitimately the first real test for Pirelli World Challenge being, in some ways, the supreme sports car endurance racing. I say endurance racing lightly, but, you know, endurance class in the United States. And they're going to rival Tudor. They may not have the Rolex 24 or maybe even the seat, but for hell, they've got the teams that do it. So, if they continue to improve, I think it's great that they start their season off at COTA. Circuit of the Americas is a hell of a venue. I love it. And, you know, I'm really intrigued to see. I love the venues they go to. They also go to Laguna Seca, you know, among other things. So we'll see what happens. So it should be a lot of fun, Josh.
Yeah, I mean, over 100 cars for Coda for this series. I mean, it just shows. I mean, we've talked about before of how Pirelli has been consistently the longest running, or I don't really want to say long running, but just consistently running sports car series for the last 25 years. I mean, Trans Am was strong, then it died off, and now it's kind of back in a somewhat limited capacity. And then IMSA's had its very high highs and very low lows. But, you know, Pirelli World Challenge has consistently been stable, and they stayed within the boundaries of what's made them successful. But they're pushing those boundaries out this year. And I think now what makes it more compelling is, you know, we've got some big sports car names. I mean, looking at the entry list, you know, we have Butch Leistinger, who runs full time, Johnny O'Connell, the ex Corvette ace, and then Chris Dice, he's going to run one of his Bentleys in the race. So yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to this season ahead.
Hey Josh, real quick, you know, I know that you're very familiar, for the fans that don't out there that don't know, Josh is really into the IndyCar scene, got a lot of good inside knowledge on a lot of different things. Josh, do you think that we might see anybody from IndyCar come into the Pirelli World Challenge and maybe run a race or two whenever, if and when they share anything, or even for that matter, the Mazda Road to Indy guys?
Well, I mean, I haven't heard anything yet, but I mean, we've seen drivers moonlight in sports car racing, and I know with some, I know the Acura Honda teams, I know that's under the HPD banner, so I mean, it wasn't surprising to see a Honda IndyCar guy. I mean, they're top dog right now, Ryan Hunter Ray. You know, seeing him like, I think would be pretty cool. So, with that, I'm gonna Adam, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up another good point that we haven't touched on, is that Pirelli World Challenge usually is a support series. They usually tag along with IndyCar or someone else. And this is one of the first major instances of them being the big show in town. It's a standalone event for them. Most of their events are temporary street circuits. So not only is it a headlining event for them, it's on a road course. So I think it just shows their growing stature in North American racing. And, Chris, do you have any closing thoughts on Pirelli World Challenge?
Do what?
Do you have any closing thoughts on Pirelli World Challenge, sir?
Sorry about that. Bit of a brain fart. I want to see how the touring car field does, because there has been a few changes, you know, drivers advancing in classes. One of the guys that I wrote about last year, Nate Stacy, 14 years old, he was Touring Car B championship runner-up, is moving up to Touring Car proper with a Volvo. I'd love to see how he does this coming weekend and in early March, whenever, you know, when PWC goes to Austin. I can't wait to see how he handles the Volvo in a faster class. Now, speaking of drivers moving up in classes, I wanted to go ahead and transition this into Mazda Road to Indy, because we have had a few driver announcements recently. The USF 2000 champion from last year, Florian Latour, was confirmed earlier today at K Motorsports with Wayne Taylor Racing's Pro Mazda program. So the lowest championship, the lowest ladder series champion has moved up. And the Indy Lights champion, Gabby Chavez, actually now has a ride with Brian Herta Autosport for a full-time IndyCar campaign. So all three of the Mazda Road Indy champions have moved up the ladder for this season. which is fantastic to see. The cool thing about this is we're going to have a fantastic Indy Lights Championship battle next year with Scott Hargrove is going to be driving at St. Petersburg for 8-Star Motorsports, and he and Spencer Pigot had a fantastic duel, and Pigot's going to be driving for Yunkos this year. With this new car, it's definitely going to create a lot more interest, and with the deeper field that we have for this coming season, I can't wait to see what's going to happen in St. Petersburg. Adam, do you have anything else to add to that?
No, other than the fact that I'm really excited to see what happens in Winterfest. I do think it's a great point to the validity of the Mazda Road to Indy Series and everything Dan Anderson and his team are doing with the fact that all three of the champions moved up. You go over to the other side of the pond and you look at all of the ladder series in Europe, it's almost impossible for some of those guys to move up now. So the very fact that the system they have in place now, supporting IndyCar in the U.S., is working, it might even be a good model for some of the guys over at the FIA to look to. It's really good to see. Joey?
I personally, LaTorre was fun to watch, and, you know, the little bit that we had a chance to see last year, you know, I'm really intrigued to see what happens with him. I think he's a hell of a talent. You know, the other, there's a handful of guys, especially at the USF 2000 ranks, that deserve a nod at Pro Mazda and will soon rightfully get it. I think it's interesting, though, when you look at a guy like him compared to somebody, say, like one of our former guests, R.C. Anderson. You know, I wonder, in some ways, I feel like LaTorre is better prepared than Anderson, but to that point, I also feel like Anderson is prepared for Indy Lights, so I really wish there was a team there that would have taken a gamble on LaTorre. But, you know, hopefully he ends up doing what he needs to do in Pro Mazda and continuing to move up the ladder, because I think this guy could be a hell of a talent for IndyCar for years to come. Josh?
Yeah. I mean, I'll be the first to admit I haven't really kept up with the Mazda Road to Indy as much as I should. But I mean, I think with Chavez moving up and getting a ride after getting the scholarship money from Mazda. I mean, even though it's with Herta, they're proven winners. I mean, they won the Indy 500 with Danny Boy, and then the next year with Tag. I mean, Tag punched above his own weight and be able to get the team above their own weight. So, you know, so, I mean, I think it's good for Chavez. But on that note, we're going to move over to the IndyCar series. We've had plenty of news in the last week, some good and some bad. I mean, first we'll go ahead and get the first bad out of the way with the season opener at Brasilia suddenly being canceled due to political reasons. And it's not going to be replaced. So guys, what are your thoughts?
Well, I don't like the fact that the season opener was canceled. I feel that IndyCar did not do its due diligence with picking this track as the place to hold the season opener. I say that because they had pictures on their Facebook page where this track was still going under construction for the last few weeks before the race. It hasn't done very well with their budget. I mean, apparently they're, you know, millions in debt. There's a big financial crisis happening in Brazil right now. And frankly, I don't think it was in IndyCar's best interest to have this race in Brazil in the first place. I wish they would have scheduled the race to go with Pirelli World Challenge in Austin, you know, months ago. But unfortunately, we can't always go what we want. Then again, it's the people that make those decisions make a lot more than I do, so it's out of my scope to worry about. Joey, Adam?
Yeah, I've got a couple of thoughts on this. You know, I understand that, you know, as it relates to races out of the country, you know, those races can pay quite a bit of money and help bring a lot of money to the sport. And to that credit, I totally understand it. And personally, I want to see IndyCar back on an international level. much like what we were used to seeing back in the older days. But you know, I come at this thing from this angle. You've always, and I've said this for years, going back from playing ball and everything else, you've got to win at home first before you can really worry about going out on the road and doing anything. And I think for IndyCar, they still haven't won America yet. And at the end of the day, you've got to go after the Phoenix International Raceway, the gateways, the, you know, what many consider historic tracks that are a part of the sport. You need to still stay true to your roots. You know, you can put every race you want at Indianapolis Motor Speedway and put a Grand Prix there and hand everybody a damn trophy, but it doesn't mean a damn thing if, you know, if nobody's watching it. So it just, at the end of the day, you've got to find a way to market this sport. You've got to do it at home. You got to do it right because, frankly, I mean, the FIA is going to laugh at you. There's a lot of fans that are going to laugh at you because Formula One reigns supreme. And on the other hand, it's nice that we're starting to get recognized by drivers and teams that are within the European Junior Series as well as F1. And that's a step in the right direction. But what they choose to do from this point on is what's going to decide the fate of IndyCar. I think they're teetering a fine line. I think that this Brasilia thing really honestly is a harsh kick in the balls, and they've got to essentially figure out how to do it right, because this is something that's going to continue to happen. They want to go to the Middle East. They want to do big things. It isn't going to work if you don't win at home. So, yeah, I can go further in depth on that little rant, but Adam, take it away.
I will chime in there and say that I think they should have gone to the Middle East. You know, there was a lot of talk of going to Dubai. Dubai is not short of money like the local government in Brasilia is. And that was the main impetus for the cancellation. It was political. It was political, but it was due to a huge shortage of funding in the local government. So it's a real shame that came up to bite IndyCar. Could they have done their homework better? Yes. I mean, they've got a ton of drivers from Brazil. There's tons of contacts in Brazil. They could have gone with Dubai and pulled it off, and it'd been great. But it's all in the past. I think they'll learn from it. The thing that's sticking me...
Real quick, Adam. Do you remember off the top of your head, and maybe Josh knows the answer to this, what were some of the older sponsors that have actually sanctioned that race just a few years back? Josh, do you have the answer to that off the top of your head?
The sponsors of the Brazil race?
Yeah, whenever,
Well, I know Itapava Beer had actually just signed to be the sponsor of the race, of this race, the day before it was canceled, so that was another kick in the head, but I'm not sure if in years past, in the street circuit in Sao Paulo, if they had a sponsor or not, but I remember seeing lots of Nestle signs up at the track, so maybe those were all just corporate, you know, and just all not a title sponsor per se, but just all sponsoring the race.
Yeah, there were a lot of local sponsors, and I don't remember if it was last year or the year before, but Itapava did special livery and sponsorship for Tony Kanaan's car. Bright red with the white lettering
of the beer. That sponsor was the Itapava beer that was going to sponsor the race.
Exactly. So, yeah, that's a shame. The thing that really kicks me, though, is the wonderful little rumor that went around that said they might go, oh, well, we'll just go ahead and race Dakota. If they thought they could just go, oh, let's go ahead and race Dakota, why wasn't it on the schedule in the first place? This takes me way back to November when NASCAR and F1 were in town at the same time, and Eddie Gossage threw a fit like a little girl, and I wrote a piece about it because I thought it was stupid. IndyCar needs to go to COTA. You don't have a world-class racetrack built in your backyard in a state where you had two races last season and not take advantage of that. So it's a shame that's not happening. I've heard they may add in another test, which is good because the aero kits are coming up. So I just want to think about going forward to the aero kits in St. Pete.
Well, you know, for the longest time, and you guys are a little bit more knowledgeable than I am about this, but, you know, for the longest time, all I kept hearing was how the FIA had some sort of hold, or I don't know a better way to put it, but, you know, they had some sort of lock as far as what the Circuit of the Americas could do outside of Formula One. And IndyCar was on kind of a restriction. Like, they weren't allowed to host an IndyCar event. I don't know how much value or how concrete that is, because a lot of that is stuff that I had heard through the grapevine from various sources. But I don't know if any of you guys, Josh, Chris, I don't know if y'all heard anything like that, but I find it very odd that if that were the case or not the case, why in the hell now do they try to even schedule something with IndyCar? To your point, Adam, you know, you've got a hell of an event in Houston that was a lot of fun to go to. You take it off the calendar. IndyCar or Formula One doesn't host the event until the week before the fall NASCAR race, Chase race. And they're a week apart in the same state, give or take 300 miles apart or so. And we're sitting here debating the IndyCar thing. They could run it at any time of the year, Pirelli World Challenge, whatever. But if there was an issue, I hadn't had any concrete evidence. Nobody's literally put it in front of me on a piece of paper that says they can't run here. So I don't understand the problem. I don't understand why IndyCar doesn't make the extra effort, because that is a state-of-the-art, world-class facility that is going to be a world-class facility for years to come. And damn it, you got to take advantage of everything. If you're not going to go after your roots, you need to take what's next. And then that would be COTA. So, Josh?
Yeah, well, I mean, in the end, it kind of comes down to money on the promoter. I mean, IndyCar is going to be a tough sell any way you look at it. You know, unfortunately, I mean, that's symptomatic of upper management with IndyCar. Which, speaking of upper management, we move to our next topic, which probably the shock heard around the open wheel racing world of Brian Barnhart being yes. That Brian Barnhart, or Robin Miller coined him, the great Brian Barnhart, has been rehired as race director for the IndyCar series. And we're talking about the same guy that restarted an oval race in the rain, you know, changed the definition of blocking at Edmonton that took Elio Castroneves out of the win. I'm not biased, even though I am an Elio fan at heart. And then we're talking about the same guy that created the pack racing that we had for all those years in the mile and half ovals, and then would scream at drivers, you know, this was coming from Miller, scream at drivers on the radio, don't race so close. Well, how ironic is that, you know, that you're yelling at the drivers for driving too close when you created the restrictor plate esque racing on those mile and a half tracks. But before I get off on a tangent here, I mean, to be fair, Barnhart does not have the same autonomy that he had last time. I mean, right now we have the three steward system where it takes a 2/3 vote to administer a penalty, and then the buck stops with Derek Walker. So I think that is a little bit of an improvement, but the problem with Barnhart, especially towards the end of his tenure, was that his reputation inside the paddock, and especially with the public, you know, from restarting the race in the rain, and then 2011 at Long Beach, you know, multiple drivers got spun. Penalties there was not a consistent amount of penalties there, but that the ebb was so low that the fact that Barnhart may have actually been right, people thought it was unfathomable. So and then not to mention he was kind of shrouded in a little bit of controversy when they brought him in at Toronto last year, and he issued a blocking call on Dario Franchitti when Dario was not blocking. It was Will Power jumped the corner trying to pass Dario, and that's where it's like, you know, given the Barnhart's reputation, it was easy to point the finger at him. So but at the end of the day, you know, Barnhart is not necessarily the problem. He's symptomatic of the problem, which is that someone at IndyCar thought it was a good idea to put him there, given his reputation. I mean, I'm not sure on who else was contacted to be the race director. I mean, I know Scott Pruitt was rumored, but Scott Pruitt said, you know, he said thanks but no thanks. And I mean, Robin Miller hinted at Wally Dallenbach Jr., but I mean, I think Wally Jr. is probably getting paid enough by Fox Sports One now to go cover NASCAR. So I don't know. I mean, we'll see. I mean, we'll see how Barnhart goes. I mean, it seems like kind of the consensus is holding judgment, but I don't know. I know too much. So guys, you have any thoughts?
No.
I have no expectations for how they'll do his job, and of course, the secret to happiness is lowered expectation, and you can't get lower than none.
Joey, Adam.
Well, you pretty much summed it up, but I do think it's interesting they kind of took him back. It's kind of like a band getting back together, or a celebrity couple getting back together. Although more surprising, honestly. I think it'll be really interesting, but, you know, the buck doesn't stop with him. He doesn't have that autonomy he had. So I will do like I am with everything with IndyCar and be cautiously optimistic. Joey?
And I've actually got one thing to credit to this, and it's, you know, Chris and I cover the Mazda Road to Indy and, you know, Indy Lights and whatnot. So how, Chris, even Josh, I'll include the whole gaggle of us here. And Chris, start with you. What do you expect out of Gabby Chavez next season, or this upcoming season, I should say, being at Brian Herta? Do you kind of expect a Jack Hawksworth kind of performance, or do you think he's kind of got the talent to maybe even deliver a W?
I don't think he's going to deliver a W, but I'm expecting maybe one or two top fives and a couple more top tens.
Yeah, I definitely don't see a win. I don't think Brian Herta is going to give him a car capable of getting a win. I don't think he'll be quite as strong as Hawksworth, but, I mean, I could see some top 10. The field is so tight, and it's almost inevitable that at least everybody's going to get one top 10. So I think he can get a couple, and that's not to disparage Gabby Chavez at all. I don't rate him quite as high as I rate Jack Hawksworth. But I'm happy to see him moving up to IndyCar. I'm happy to see Brian Herta keeping that going. So we'll see. Josh?
Yeah, I mean, I think Chavez, I see a top five here and there. I mean, I do think that Chavez is really, really talented. And, you know, I'm sure that, you know, the extra money he's bringing from Mazda, I mean, I'm not sure if that'll help out Herta and to allow him to bring some extra resources in. I mean, it depends. It depends whether or not, you know, the 98 car made the leaders circle program, which that has not been announced yet. Which continuing on the topic of silly season, Connor Daly tested at Sebring for Schmidt Peterson Motorsports, and you know, no official lap times were reported, but I heard lap times around the North Circuit at Sebring were around the 57 and or 59 second range, and Connor apparently matched his teammate, the newcomer to the team, James Hinchcliffe. He apparently matched his time. So I mean, it looks like the test went good, but with Connor, it's unfortunately that's going to come down to money, because the second Schmidt car needs funding, and the other candidate for that seat, I have learned through other sources, I mean, including Marshall Pruitt, a racer, I'll give credit where credit's due, you know, that Simone De Silvestro has actually resurfaced and is raising the necessary funds to potentially get a ride. And, I mean, she didn't confirm whether or not she was talking to Schmidt, but Marshall also hinted at a possible part-time drive with Andretti. I mean, I know Andretti wants to run a fifth car. I mean, I think Simone said it best, you know, at this point in her career, she wants to be with a good team. I mean, I think, you know, Simone is definitely worthy of that. I mean, she's tough on the road courses, and, you know, she was improving on the ovals. I mean, I think the world of her. You know, she's easily the best female road racer next to Desiree Wilson. So, but probably the next best part of the silly season, you know, probably the best news was Luca Filippi getting that ride in the number 20 car for the road and street circuits. I mean, I think Luca is a stud. I mean, he would have finished second at Houston in 2013 had it not been for a late caution that forced him and Will Power to pit. But Luca is, I mean, if they couldn't get Conway back, Luca is the next best thing. So, guys, what are your thoughts on the current Philly season state of affairs?
Well, I'll take this one to jump on. I think, first off, Jeremy Chavez is a talented driver, and it's nice that he's in a Brian Herta Autosport car, but Mikhail Alosian, to me, is 10 times more talented, and it's incredibly sad to know that, and I've said this for a couple of shows now, but I'm just pretty pissed off about it. He deserves a ride, and I mean, I'm sorry, but when you I know that racing has its money, has its politics, but you know what? At the end of the day, we need to be able to figure out a way to put the most talented guy on the grid, plain and simple. It doesn't matter. I mean, I'm going to reference, and I'll put an F1 reference out there. If you can explain to me how Charles Peake was able to get sponsorship all those years in a back marker or, you know, other, yeah, I'll say it, crap drivers like Noreen Karthikeyan out there on a damn seat, but yet you've got somebody like Sam Bird chilling out winning GP2 constantly, and Felipe Nasr finally getting his shot, and luckily it's in a, you know, a decent car, not the greatest of situations. Meanwhile, Adrian Sutil's wasting everybody's time. So I just, to reference that in IndyCar, you got guys like Mikhail Alosian sitting on the sidelines, you know, and it just, Simona Di Silvestro, definitely. That woman wouldn't win a fuel mileage IndyCar race like Danica Patrick. She would straight up take it to him. You know, she's got all the talent in the world, and nobody, you know, she left, and part of the victim of her own circumstances, because she saw greener pastures at F1, and honestly, if you had the writing on the wall between F1 and IndyCar, what are you going to choose as a driver? That just sounds like common sense to me. But now you got all these F1 guys coming over to us. At the end of the day, you know, these sponsors, these companies that sponsor these drivers need to wise up and know the talent they've got, and, you know, and know what talent actually is. So, and I think, that's my little rant on your little Philly season thought process. And with that, I hand it over to Adam.
I think I'll speak for Joey and all of us, but especially Joey. I think he's a little sad that Mikhail is not going to be there, that Vladimir is putting him out the pasture.
A bunch of crap.
As it were. But I'm happy Luca Felici's getting a chance. I think he's got a ton of talent. I am really glad to see him getting to kind of fill the Mike Conway void. Now that Mike Conway is going to be with Toyota full time. So that's great. I really do hope Simona can come back. Unfortunately for Daly, I think she'll probably get that seat if she can bring more sponsorship, because she can bring better exposure.
Wait. Let me ask you something. Adam.
Yes.
Who do you believe is more talented, Connor Daly or Simona?
Simona.
By how much?
11.4%.
11.4%.
Precisely.
How about you, Josh? Do you think Simona has more talent than Connor Daly?
Well, I would say yes, just from an experience standpoint of, I mean, it's kind of hard to judge, being that Simona and Connor have they've only raced against each other one time. Keep in mind, Connor was in Takuma Sato's backup car at the Indy 500, so he wasn't very well assimilated with the car. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Connor's proven himself in GP3 and GP2. I mean, didn't really have the opportunity to fully prove himself. But, I mean, Simona, you know, a writer a few years ago said she's got bigger balls than Paul Tracy. So, and you know, if you saw her at Houston in 2013, and if you saw her in the opening laps of 2011 at St. Petersburg, when she bumper carred her way to the front and got and passed 15 cars in the first two opening restarts, you know, I mean, that pretty much speaks for itself.
How about you, Chris? Now that we're, well, let's complete the roundtable here.
I would have to say Simona a little bit more, but for experience, like Josh said. However, I do think that if Connor and Simona were in the same car, it would be very difficult to pick a winner. Unless, of course, they're on an oval, which is, I think Connor Daly has the edge. On a road course, I think it's roughly even.
And I think it's really interesting that Joey was bringing up Philippe Nasr, finally getting his big chance and going over to Sauber, which is where Simona was trying to begin with. And that just goes back to an ever-present problem in the world of racing, and that is funding. Especially in Formula One, hop back over there for half a second. If Sauber wasn't having so many financial issues, that could be Simona. We could have been seeing going around the rest, testing this past week. Now she's trying to come back to IndyCar. I think it'll happen. I think Daly will also eventually get a ride in IndyCar. But you know, it will all be revealed soon. We're all complaining about the first race being canceled and March being so far away, but it'll be here before we know it. And the thing I'm most excited about is the introduction of the aero kit. There hasn't been as much talk about that lately, with all the positions changing in management, with the Brasilia race being canceled and things like that going on. But I think that's what's going to stand out for IndyCar this year. I think it's going to be a wonderful thing. What are you guys' thoughts, Joey?
I mean, as far as the aero kit's going, is that what you're asking me here? Okay. You know, I got to think that one's probably going to have a better horse under the hood, or I shouldn't really say hood, but, you know, you get the idea.
On it. And engine cover.
There you go.
Yeah.
And, boy, that's just too original. What if I just said that in my everyday car? Let me get that dang their engine right under their engine cover. How's that thing running?
Pretty good, Jim Bob. You just switch over to NASCAR a little bit early on us?
Yeah, a little bit, man. But I think one's going to have the better motor, and I think one's going to just have a better setup for aero. One's going to be better on the straight on the street courses, road courses, and the other one's going to be better on the oval. So I don't like the fact that their first chance to touch any of this on an oval is Indianapolis, but I really would be more in favor of trying it at like Milwaukee earlier in the season and trying to flip the date, or if nothing else, giving more tests for it. I know it costs money, but frankly, you know, IndyCar's got to do something. You don't want to put a piece of shit product out on the damn track. So, you know, to quote A.J. Foyt, who's definitely a hero after last year in Houston, you don't want a bunch of goddamn idiots out there.
Pretty sure A.J. Foyt was a hero a couple decades before last year.
For me.
Oh,
you know.
Okay.
But, respect A.J. But, you know, actually, he was my hero when he decided to punch Ari Leyendijk. But that's a different story. But
especially for Ari Leyendijk.
Sure. I don't even understand why everybody thinks that guy's so talented. But anyway, that's going to piss him off. But, oh.
Woo!
So, but, yeah, that's what I think as far as the aero kits go and everything else. How about you, Chris?
Well, the only thing I want to say about this, honestly, what you just said, is Adam, I am sorry that you were at Pikes Peak that weekend. Because
I am too.
Because when Foyt said that on TV, the entire media center just erupted. And it was one of the funniest things. Oh, no, I just broke something. It was one of the funniest things I can remember from this past year in racing. Other than when Mike Conway was driving the Toyota in the rain at Austin, and he slid it to a stop, and everybody was clapping for him in there.
Oh, that was
Josh.
The slip and slide.
Yeah. Well. Moving back to the aero kits, I agree with Joey that I think the first oval test for them at I think at the Indy 500. I mean, obviously racing is inherently dangerous, but I mean, Indy's the biggest track we go to. The speeds are going to be at at their peak at Indy. I mean pole speed for Indy was 231 this past year, or was it 233? Can't remember. It was in the excess of 230s, and now they're wanting to get a new track record at Indy in the next couple of years. So, but beside that, I think the aero kits are going to be a good thing. I mean, that they're built by respected companies. I mean, HPD and Pratt and Milner. I mean, they've proven themselves in sports car racing and other forms of racing. So, I mean, we'll see at St. Petersburg if it improves the speed of the cars. So I think whether or not it's going to move the needle in the long run for IndyCar is, you know, I think that is yet to be seen. So, Joey?
I just actually, I wanted to chime in on one thing that you said, and that was talking about how they're determined to break this, lap record, speed record at Indy. Could you imagine if that happened this year, knowing that they haven't tested it at all, and knowing that they literally, the second they unload that thing, could be pushing out speeds that are going to be pretty close to what they've already ran, and we already know how everything goes in the month of May. Like, you can start off running in 215s and 212s. By the end of the month, you're running 233, 231. You get the kinks worked out, you trim out the car. I think that it's, you know, this sport took a huge hit with Vegas and with the loss of Dan Weldon, and in some ways the irresponsibility to look at a rule or look at many rules and put 33 cars out on a mile and a half high bank oval. Frankly, it doesn't matter if fence posts are in or out when they're talking about that crap, but that's discussion for another day. But when we're sitting here looking at this, I just don't understand how you can be so determined to break something like that. And yeah, the DW12 chassis has proven to be great, but, you know, and there's something to be said for racing, always pushing the envelope, but I think that there comes a point where you're wanting too much and you need to be satisfied with what you get. And frankly, the product's good. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Maybe change the way you market the damn thing. But, and it's nice to see these aero kits, but I would be, you know, dragsters go, pro stock drivers go 299 and a few other odds and ends. And on a quarter mile, eighth mile, what have you, and a third mile, whatever they've changed it to now for NHRA. And then you've got 1,000 feet. There you go, folks. And then you got funny cars that'll go 337. That's for 3 seconds. We're talking about guys going around for 500 miles, 2.5 hours at a 2.5 mile oval. And if they're pushing 240 miles an hour, I mean, we saw them here at Texas when Cart was running 240 in these corners. And granted, the banking is a hell of a lot higher here, but they were talking about fading in the corners. I don't want a situation like that, because when that happened, Cart was going downhill at that point. They were pushing way too hard, way too out of their element. And it just, to me, Indy, that's a bad move on IndyCar's part personally, and I'm kind of pissed off about it because I love open wheel. Josh?
Yeah, well, I mean, another thing about the track record is that keep in mind when Ari set the track record in 96, that was the first year of the IRL, and, you know, I mean, a very dark time for open wheel racing. But, you know, that year, you know, the IRL rules were pretty much allowed unlimited boost. You know, I mean, I won't get into the politics of it, but, you know, the track record before that was set by Roberto Guerrero, who went 232 in the ultra quiet Menard V6 Buick. On that Buick it was fast, quiet, unreliable. But you know, it's like that track record was kind of set under kind of shaky rules, trying to essentially the IRL was a very weak hand at that point. I mean, in that field, you know, you had Lyon-Dyke, you had Tony Stewart, and you had a few other talented drivers, but then you also had Bronco Brad Murphy, Joe Gosek, Scott Harrington, and Racing Gardner, where over there in Michigan that you had Jimmy Vassar, Michael Andretti, Zanardi, and Al Unser Jr., Scott Pruitt, and the list goes on, that it was pretty much power play by the IRL and all parties involved to show CART what they had just by making the speed higher. So I think that kind of makes the that being said, the track record at Indy, you know, yeah, give credit to Treadway Racing and Ari Leyendyke. They trimmed the car out, and Ari legitimately lapped the circuit with a 237 average. But still, the track record was kind of set in those and under those shady circumstances. So I think maybe pushing, I think on that being said, pushing 240 at Indy, you know, 240 at Fontana. Fontana's wide, and Fontana's built for open wheel cars. That's wide enough where Indy was essentially designed on 1909 standards for cars meant to go 100 miles an hour, and so yeah, I mean new track records aren't necessarily going to put butts in the seats. I mean, think about it. NASCAR with the Gen 6 car. I mean, Tony Stewart set a 200 mile an hour average lap during qualifying for the Texas 500 in November, but I don't recall anybody jumping up and down and screaming because of it, other than maybe the announcers. So guys, do you have any other thoughts on that?
Well, it's a tin top versus a cockpit. So I mean, that's the only reason why I think maybe there is a difference. You hit a wall in a stock car, it hurts like hell, but you got a better chance of walking away from it than you do in an Indy car. You know, that's just that's my take on it. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to call in, the number is 347-838-9215. You can chime in, ask us a question, or chime in on this fun discussion before we get ready to trade topics to something else. Josh, I'd love to start with you and then kind of move over to the other guys. But knowing what's going on with Brasília, knowing what's going on with kind of this haywire off season that honestly feels like an eternity in the IndyCar world for the fans of the sport. If there was, outside of the obvious schedule change with the length of the schedule or the length of the off season, if you were going to look at the sport itself and you had a chance to get hands-on with something, what is maybe something you would look at changing that many of us may not see?
Well, I think that, I mean, I'm going to speak for, I'm going to kind of, yeah, I think the thing I would probably change is the commercial division. And, you know, because right now, you know, where IndyCar stands right now with its current ownership, it's pretty much all about, I mean, it's pretty much all about making May better. I mean, think about, you know, Mark Miles got the Grand Prix of Indianapolis to open the month of May to get the whole month of May on television on ABC. So, you know, we have Indy 500 qualifying on ABC and along with the 500 and the Grand Prix of Indianapolis. And hate to say it, but we're kind of sinking back into the USAC phase that we had before Dan Gurney wrote white paper and formed CART. And that's where, you know, I mean, say what you want about CART. CART kind of choked on itself at the end, but CART in its heyday legitimately has been the only organization to run a legitimate IndyCar series. You know, say what you want about the owners. I mean, that's one thing about CART is the owners, inmates running the asylum. You know, I think that is, that is unworkable in its own right. But essentially, it's, you know, IndyCar needs some better. It needs better leadership of people that want to run it like a racing business. I mean, it's kind of run like a civic enterprise. I mean, think about this. Do you think it's overall good for the series to end the season at Sonoma? I mean, can you think of an even more boring track next to Mid-Ohio? You know, and that's because they end the season by Labor Day, and that pretty much that pissed Fontana off because Fontana can't fill out seats on Labor Day weekend. It's not a good market for Southern California, and there's been other casualties of Labor Day, including you know, Baltimore and Houston. I mean Baltimore was kind of, Baltimore was kind of rough to begin with, but I mean, Houston, you know, fourth largest city in America, fourth largest media market in America, and you had Shell and Pennzoil, you know, dumping money into that race, and now you you pissed off them, they're a Fortune 500 company. So it's essentially, like not wanting to compete against football, and we've talked about this before on the show of IndyCar not trying to, they don't want to step on NASCAR's toes or the NFL or what have you, but, you know, I mean, competing against NASCAR, open wheels versus stock cars, just, I mean, competing against them, that's their competition, and that's the name of the game. So Chris, Adam, Joey, do you guys have any thoughts on this?
I honestly don't.
I think you just knocked it out of the park, Josh. It's never really recovered from the split. It's never really recovered from the mismanagement of CART. I'm more optimistic, though, about IndyCar now than at any time in our lifetime. So I think they're on the right track. But these little stumbling blocks that keep coming up just prove that they're not quite there yet. And the sad thing is that while it's been bad for IndyCar, it's been good for NASCAR. That's not necessarily bad for racing as a whole. But I think what IndyCar needs to focus on now is to show America that there's racing beyond NASCAR, and to show the world at large, which knows that IndyCar has some of the best on-track product of any racing series there is. It's a
right.
lot of talent, a lot of great drivers, a lot of great teams and owners and engineers and designers, and that's the message they need to get out there. So what I would fix is the PR side, is the media relations side. They need guys, more guys like us, scouting out the good gospel, as it were, saying, hey, IndyCar is great. If you want to see a great race, turn on IndyCar. You don't have to watch NASCAR. You don't have to watch only F1 or Rally or WEC or whatever. You know, pick your poison, or if you're a motorcycle guy. The greatest thing I think about racing is the variety of it and the multiple disciplines and the guys trying different things. And part of the vision Joey and I have for all of this is to share that and to spread that. And I'm no bigger fan of a series than IndyCar. I root for them like crazy. So that's what they need. Is that right there?
You know, I think it's interesting, Josh, you touched on ending a season at literally the most boring racetrack ever in the history of the universe. And yet, 2 weeks later, the Mazda Road to Indy season ends at Laguna Seca, which has traditionally always been a fantastic circuit for open wheel historically.
Yep.
You know, I find it so interesting that Dan Anderson, you know, there's a few, you know, a few friends that I know, and that they believe that IndyCar, Indy Lights runs as does IndyCar, and you know, and as does Pro Mazda and so on and so forth. And to a degree, that is 100% true. But I think what's so interesting is how Dan Anderson is refusing to allow IndyCar to handicap his product. Because let's be honest here. He single-handedly put a great team together and put a hell of a product out there for the Mazda Road to Indy. And these kids coming in, I mean, that's the reason we have Sage Karam. That's the reason RC Anderson is up at this top level. That's the reason that we've got all these teams right now that are hitting Indy Lights. I mean, they've got a crap ton of teams, some of them that left sports car racing to go touch Indy Lights. You know, European junior level teams that are well-renowned, like Carlin. And, you know, I don't understand how somebody like Dan Anderson can put a hell of a great team together. And just, even though you don't know these drivers, you know that this product is doing exactly what it should. And yet, and it's doing it very well. So they don't market it. They don't do a whole lot of things. And to that flaw, maybe that falls on IndyCar, or maybe that just wouldn't work if he moved up to IndyCar, because he would still have the same problem. I have no idea. But I know whatever the hell he's doing, it's working. And IndyCar better figure something out quick, because ending the season, I mean, I don't even understand how you go to Sonoma when you got Laguna Seca just down the road. That's just, that pisses me off. But moving on, it's been a fun IndyCar segment, and we've been on it a little while. And once again, feel free to call in The number is 347-838-9215. And we've got, give or take, about 35 minutes left here on In the Gravel Trap. And we're going to talk a little bit. Adam, you've got some news on this new Nissan program for the endurance sports car world.
Yes. I know many of you out there, like I, thought the most interesting moment of the Super Bowl was the Nissan commercial. It was a little heavy-handed with the cats in the cradle, but I loved seeing the new car. I love that they were testing it at COTA. Dakota talked to some people down there who got to be part of that. I just want to hear your thoughts on this. Revolutionary car designed by Ben Bowlby, the father of the Delta Wing, and then the Nissan Z-Ode RC car. It is front engine. It is a hybrid like all LMP1 machines with a 3-liter twin turbo V6 at the petrol power plant. But it's front engine, front wheel drive. The front tires are bigger and wider than the rears, 14 inches wide at the front versus 9 at the rear. It looks extremely low drag. I think we might see a new straight line speed record. I think it might be the kind of thing Nissan's looking forward to at Le Mans. They just announced their first lineup with Olivier Pla, Harry Signal, and Kikujio Matsuda. And Marc Genet is also part of the program. They're going to run three cars at Le Mans because WEC officially unveiled the 56-car entry list today for the race. So we'll have three Nissans, three Audis, three Porsches going up against two Toyotas for the win, with one of the Lotus cars and two of the Rebellion cars, which just switched over to the AER Turbo. Ditching the Toyota V8. So I'm really excited about this Nissan car. What are your thoughts, Joey?
I don't think Nissan designed it. I think they got the plans from Tim Burton from the very first Batman movie. Those are my thoughts. I think it's going to be a fun team. I was really hoping I'd see Nick Heidfeld do more with the Nissan program. That's about the only thing. But frankly, I love Rebellion. Heidfeld's my dude, so we'll see what happens from there. Chris?
One thing that I wanted to bring up with with the Le Mans entry list, ESM having two cars on there, and Krone also having a car in LMP2, we're starting to get a more American contingent, a bigger American contingent in the 24 hours of Le Mans. In addition to, you know, Corvette Racing as well in the GTE Pro class, and also the Corvettes being sold to Larbra for the GTE AM. One thing that I was kind of shocked about with regards to the Le Mans 24-hour entry list, I'm sorry if I guess I was the person that brought it up, but Toyota has only two cars on there. What do you guys think about that? Don't you think you should have three on the Le Mans entry list?
Yeah, I think it's... I don't know if they're getting cocky because they finally won, you know, the WEC championship this past year, and pretty handily. We were all down at COTA in the WEC round there in September, and that was the car to beat. It was, even though it didn't win, it was the fastest car there. So, yeah, I don't understand why they don't have a third car, though. When Audi's got three cars, Porsche's got three cars, Nissan has three cars, Toyota needs that three.
Never thin out your resources. Ever. You expand too much, too fast, and you become an average team. That sucks. We saw it with Andretti. We've seen it with Ganassi. We're about to see it with Penske.
It's a different series.
I don't really care. If the same rules apply, Roush did it with five cars in NASCAR. They sucked. The only two drivers they had that were worth a damn were Jeff Burton and Mark Martin. You recall Chad Little, Johnny Benson, and Ted Musgrave? Please. It sucks. If you can't get enough resources and enough people and enough of the right product to put something together, you don't need to expand. You need to kick ass with two. I'd rather go to a race with one badass car and a bunch of badass people than to have those badass people spread between three teams. So, no. I am not surprised.
Joey just got some mid-show coffee. He's a little amped up, everybody.
Amped up hell.
I want to mention
maybe spreading yourself too thin, but I'm really happy for them. Oak Racing has no fewer than 5 of their new Ligier JSP2s entered in for the P2 class. They've got G-Drive Racing, Oak Racing, their own squad, and they also have Crone Racing. So the P2 field, despite P1 being headlined and getting all the big attention with the big name manufacturers and Rebellion and Lotus tagging along, P2 is still thriving. I think that'll be a very interesting class to watch. Chris?
Well, I love that the Ligier has a larger, I guess, presence in LMP2, I should say. That car, unfortunately, didn't do so well at Daytona. But I am looking forward to seeing if it can stand up to 24 hours at Le Mans. It did do a good job over at COTA in the Tudor race out there. It did very well, actually, in Tudor in the few races that it was in. But I hope that it has better luck than Michael Schenck had with that car at Daytona. One thing I also wanted to kind of bring up regarding the entry list is that we do have 3 hang on a second, let me get the entry list right here. Here it is. We do have I'm looking at GTE Amateur right now. We have easily 40% of the field is Ferraris. Actually, I think almost half of it as Ferraris, but only 2 of them in GTE Pro. I think that if Ferrari wanted to have a more competitive entry in GT, that they should have maybe 1 or 2 more cars in GTE Pro than GTE Am, because Scuderia Corsa from Tudor is going to be in GTE Am. And they have Corsa has 5 cars in there, but 3 of them are in GTE Am, or 2 of them are in Pro. And I really wish that they had a couple more GTE Pro cars there. But then again, you know, we can't necessarily control everything that's on there. But there is a good, healthy LMP2 field.
I'll agree with you on Adam? That Ferrari issue there, Chris. Just specifically because if you look at the entry list, the first reserve list is Riley Motorsports in the GTEM category with the SRT Viper. They had a real Cinderella moment coming back to GT Daytona from starting last and taking victory in class at Daytona a couple weeks ago after Fiat Chrysler axing the program after they won the inaugural Tudor Championship in their division. So I'd like to see them get the bump up to go over to France. There's nothing quite like a big V10 front engine American sports car going around barreling through the French countryside. But the usual suspects in all the GT field, the Ferraris, the Astons, the Porsches, the Corvettes. But I'm really looking forward to it. It's always close. The prototypes are going to have the lion's share of the coverage, but if it's a runner, we've got the GT field to back it up. I want to transition now. We've got 27 minutes left on the air to Formula One. The season has officially begun. The cars have been unveiled at the end of last week, and we had the first 4 days of testing at Jerez in Spain. And interestingly enough, a Ferrari-powered car has led the timesheet every single session. Mercedes have racked up a record amount of first test mileage, but if you look at the mileage the teams racked up last year and the failures, last year, at the first test, Red Bull only managed 23 laps. They're in the hundreds. Ferrari's around 300-something. Mercedes is at 500. Times are much quicker. Everyone seems a lot happier, even with the cars that were good last year. The teams are happier. The cars where they were bad, they're happier. I think it's going to be a quicker F1 season, a more reliable season, and I am really excited. It is finally here. Joey?
That new Ferrari looks sexy, doesn't it?
I knew you were going to say that. I mean, that and the Toro Rosso. I mean, you just look at that Ferrari, and I don't know. I mean, part of this is the FIA being a little stricter with the nose rules and a few other odds and ends. But you just look at that car, and that looks like a car you don't screw with. And I think that it'll shovel you out of the way. Well, I mean, it beats the Hoover vacuum cleaner that it was last year, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
But, you know, I look at it, and number one, I'm excited to see this team. And, you know, I know that this is honestly, for lack of a better term, this is more than likely Kimi's last ride. Kimi Räikkönen, their last world champion. It would be, in my opinion, very fitting if he storybooked his career at Ferrari with world championship. And I, for one, would love to see it because I can't say Mercedes. But their German cars cut me off the road so often that I just naturally don't like German automobiles. But, you know, I also think about this is look at what it could do for Sebastian Vettel. Like, I understand there's going to be people and critics that are going to say, well, you and Daniel Ricciardo, you left because you got your ass kicked by Daniel Ricciardo. But, you know, let's look at it for what it was. He's always wanted to be a Ferrari driver. He moved to a team that honestly struggled mightily last year. I don't care if you like Alonso or not. That team sucked. And, you know, you're sitting here barely pacing with a Force India. You got problems if you're a, you know, stallion from Italy, and it just shouldn't be like that. But I think that it works in a couple of ways with him. For Vettel, I personally loved it when he first stepped in that BMW ride as a replacement. I loved it when he was at Toro Rosso. And he was that new fan favorite, that young kid on the block that people could pull for to go up against the Alonzos and the bigger names on the sport that honestly kind of handicapped F1 for a lot of years. And then lo and behold, people start hating him because all he does is win. And so I think that this is a great, you know, in a way for him and his career and becoming a fan favorite. It's a great way to push him into a better place, especially after what Mercedes did last year.
Could not agree more, and they say times don't mean anything at the first test, but we obsess over them anyway. Kimi and Seb were both over a half second quicker than the third best time set at the test, which incidentally was the Sauber, which was another Ferrari-powered car. Kimi made a lot of positive noises. What were you going to say?
Who will be over 1.1 seconds faster than, to quote David Hobbs' voice, which is terrible,
Lewis Hamilton?
There you go.
That was terrible, by the way.
I'm not good with the voices, unlike Mr. Adam Tate. You know, I do know that Lewis Hamilton has officially got his ass kicked at a test session, and it's beautiful. And I realize I've said ass a lot on the air tonight.
Yes, you have. Well, you'll be happiest about this. And Kimi's probably getting a little bit of a snicker out of it. Kimi had the fastest time at the test day. A minute 20.841. It was on soft, so it's not super significant. But the slowest best lap any driver had was Alonso in his new McLaren Honda. It's a 135.553. So, did only 80 laps, McLaren and Honda did as a team. The next lowest was Red Bull, all the way at 155. So, Boullier says he's very proud that they got that many, that the car's very extreme, that the rear's packaged really tightly, that he's really optimistic. And those are the noises you want your team principal to be making. But are McLaren and Honda in trouble? Are they going to be on the back foot starting the year? What do you think? They've got Jensen with the continuity, they have Alonso, they've got all the experience in the world. But it looks like we may be seeing Ferrari rise back up, Lotus rise back up. It looks like Mercedes is still up there. Lotus is still up there. Felipe said they've even taken a step forward. Pretty exciting. Where do Red Bull, with Kvyat arguably not being on the level Vettel was, partnering Ricciardo, and where do McLaren Honda fit into this?
Well, first off, who doesn't like a well-packaged rear? But, you know, if I've got to look at this thing, number one, Aaron Bouillier has got his work cut out for him at McLaren Honda. I mean, you're only running 80 laps, and, I mean, would you have water cooling issues? Mm-hmm. There's a variety of different issues.
Yeah, Mercedes runs 516 laps to your 80.
And, you know, aside from that, though, I actually want to touch on this. You've got veteran drivers there, and right now you're not running anything for laps. And you almost feel like, yes, that's where the veteran talent would come in compared to a Kevin Magnussen. And that's why the signing made more sense, perhaps, because you have that veteran leadership. But you know what? Laps for laps, experience is experience, and they're learning this with a new power plant. So that, to me, they are just behind the eight ball with what a Kevin Magnussen would have been if he would have stepped in that car. And, you know, that's just it's unfortunate. But yeah, I want to touch on something, and that's a team that I'm a fan of one driver. I can't stand the other. And but this car got a full year of development without the tutelage of Eric Bouillier, and that's this Lotus switching to a Mercedes power plant. You know, it's good to see Grosjean happy again. It's great to see him run around the paddock, because if there's anybody that actually has talent, everybody wants to brag about Daniel Ricciardo. Well, 2 years ago, that was Romain Grosjean. I mean,
a year ago. A year and a half.
So, you know, I look at this, and it's great to see him set up again. It's great to see him happy. I think he's going to deliver some pretty decent results. Will they be podiums? Maybe, if he's got a crazy race with a lot of wrecks at Monaco, but it's Monaco. But the nose looks better. The car looks better. He's happier. Pastor Maldonado has got a renewed PDVSA that, you know, is guaranteed to probably buy them 7 more cars that he'll take out this year. But so they're set up good over there. And we'll see what happens with the second team, but I'd give him one more year. I understand that you're biased with Williams, and that you
marginally
is a bunch of crap. But you know, who is it that really sticks out to you when you look at the design of the car, what we saw in Jerez, and the way some of these drivers handled it, the way the teams actually handled some of the adversity that they faced? Who do you like?
The thing that means the most to me is not necessarily laps completed. Red Bull completed crap for laps last year, and you know, came out of the gate very strong once the season began. It's driver feedback, and a couple things stand out to me on that. Mercedes is still in good shape. They'll probably still be the favorites. The thing Lewis and Nico both harped on was reliability. We ran so many laps. It's so reliable. It's a good baseline, yada, yada, yada. So they're excited, but they also mentioned, Nicky Lauda also mentioned, everybody's kind of looking over their shoulder at Ferrari. And Vettel doesn't have experience with the old car, per se. But he made positive noises. But Kimi was very positive, as positive as Kimi Raikkonen can be about a thing like this, saying that it's a whole new car. It's a lot of improvement. It's a way better place than they were last year. So I look Ferrari, I look at them to take a step forward, and Williams. Massa said it's already a clear step ahead of last year's car, and he thinks that they can challenge for wins. He said maybe only one win. Ferrari said, you know, maybe they only get two.
Do you think they'll actually have the right strategy to not screw them out of something like what they did at Canada?
Gosh, I hope so. Massa should have won at Canada. Could have won at Canada.
You don't pit a guy. They should have already won.
And the bad pit stop is really what it cost them anyway.
Yeah.
I think Williams and Ferrari can definitely win races. I think Red Bull can still win races. I do think it's going to be a lot harder for Daniel Ricciardo to carry that team with someone as inexperienced as Kvyat in the next season.
You know, looking at Mercedes, they ran so strong last year, and obviously they're running so many laps. They're finding out the durability and maximizing the engine life, and chassis life, seeing how far they can really push it. Because let's be honest, fresher power plants at the end of the year is what helped Lewis Hamilton. That being said, I mean, do you see a situation to where, honestly, Mercedes stays so far ahead of all these teams that we're sitting here talking about that we're hoping and ranting and raving have got their stuff put back together and can get back on track?
I don't think so. I think
they still go in as the favorites because last year was so dominant for them. But this is one of my favorite things about Formula One. If we go back a year from now, everyone was bellyaching. The fans were upset. The media was upset. The teams were upset. These cars are too high-tech. They're too unreliable. They're too slow. They're not loud enough. They suck. They break down all the time. And look, a year later, you know, we've got a team that's put in over 500 laps in only 4 days of testing. The amount of progress and the rate of development in Formula One is staggering. It's like NASA in the 1960s. So they love to bellyache. The only real legitimate one for me is that costs are too high. Everyone knows that. But they've got some of the brightest engineers and scientists and strategists in the world working with the best drivers in the world. And I can't help but think some of those guys are going to get the pieces together well enough to where Mercedes doesn't have it all their own way in 2016.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting, though, is like last year we got so used to seeing, obviously outside of Red Bull Infinity with Ricciardo and Vettel, but we saw a lot of the teams that were privately funded, more privately funded. No team is 100% privately funded. But you saw most of them not wasting away a lot of test laps. You know, we saw Lotus, who, no, they're not actually owned by Lotus folks. That right there is as private as a team as maybe they have outside of Sauber. But, you know, they didn't have a whole lot of laps. They didn't do a whole lot of things. But this year we're seeing a very nice even spread between Sauber, between Mercedes, between Lotus, between McLaren. You know, Williams is right in the thick of it. So I'm excited because we're seeing development, for lack of a better word, equal across the board. McLaren Honda screwed, and, you know, not liking Fernando Alonso so much. I really enjoy that, but apparently Adam agrees. He's a little bitter about some Massa Hungary stuff. But
Germany,
whatever. Same. It's Europe. But
wow.
Anyway, two teams that were there last year that weren't there this year. We're going to talk a little bit about Marussia. You know, the F1 Strategy Group rejected the bid by Marussia to keep their 2014 car for this upcoming season. So, I mean, it's just, you know, it's more trouble for Marussia. It's going to be even more increasingly difficult than it already was, not to mention the assets and everything else that they've had that Gene Haas is gearing up for to work with. And then, even worse off, Caterham's assets are set to be auctioned online, of all things. So, you know, just go to eBay if you want your, you know, front wing element.
If you want anteater nose, if I win the lottery, I will try and buy one of those cars and get a private test day for a fan. What the heck? It is really sad. It is the death knell for both of those teams. Caterham certainly gone. Marussia following quickly behind now. The strategy group didn't let them in. Not surprising. It's, you know, grounds of safety, and they don't want to bend the rules. But it's always sad when a group of guys that got together and really tried couldn't quite put it all together. So I know Joe usually mentions this, but every time we talk about Marussia, we want to talk about Jules Bianchi. So, Forza Jules, everyone's thoughts and prayers are still with him. And with that, we shall transition a little bit over to the tone in Joey's voice that says, all right, Europe, and talk about some NASCAR, because we've got Speed Week and Daytona rapidly approaching.
Well, you just took the words right out of my mouth, because I was about to say, hey, the Super Bowl just ended, and it was glorious because the Seahawks lost. What time of the year does that mean? That means Daytona's right around the corner.
Ah, yeah.
But
cheaters.
Thanks for that.
Great history of cheating in NASCAR as well.
It's racing. If there's a gray area, Chad Knauf will find it.
Yes, he will.
Along with anybody else. You know, we're getting ready for what is Speed Week? What is the greatest time for a race fan outside of the month of May and for me Memorial Day weekend, which is phenomenal. But Sprint Unlimited's coming up, and, you know, pole winners, past winners, everything else. gearing up for what is sure to be a fun Saturday night on the 14th, Valentine's Day. So celebrate with your loved one at a fun racetrack, at a fun TV near you watching the race, if you can't go to the racetrack.
Yeah. The ladies love the racetrack, let me tell you.
They do. They love the engines. I'm just saying. The tight rear ends, man. But anyway, well packaged, as Adam just put it. But, Chris, you and I have talked a little bit of NASCAR in the past, and, there's quite a few guys at Daytona. I mean, restrictor plate racing for these guys, you can almost just draw a name out of a hat, and that's about as good as you're going to get as far as who's going to win. But gearing up for Speed Weeks and some good guys on restrictor plate racing, who are some that you're going to keep your eye on?
I think we should keep an eye on, well, of course, Dale Earnhardt Jr., not just because of the Earnhardt name, but because he's won a couple of 500s, and he's tends to do pretty well at the restrictor plate races, although, in my opinion, we can't keep our eye away from Kevin Harvick too much or Jeff Gordon, considering this is Jeff's last year doing full-time Sprint Cup driving. I would like to see what the rest of Stuart Haas Racing can do, namely Ryan Newman and Kurt Busch. I want to see what they're going to be able to do this coming year with Tony Stewart, back at full strength. I think they're going to create a very good package for the Frederick Plate races this year, especially at Daytona.
I think it's, as far as anything goes for the season, I think this is a must-win season for Casey Kane as far as, he's got to do something to save his ride at Hendrick, because even though he's fast as hell, he's getting torched by his other three compadres there. But that's a different story for a different time. I like you. I mean, Dale Jr. is always a guy to watch for restrictor plate racing. A name that always seems to be pretty solid at Daytona and honestly very happy with their engine program. But I've got to – if I'm looking just underneath the surface, Jamie McMurray always seems to show up when you least expect him to, and it's always at the big races. I mean, let's look at the Rolex 24 just a couple weeks ago. You look at what he's done. He's won the Brickyard 400. He's won the 500. And, he's always been good at restrictor plate racing. So, if there was a guy, obviously somebody like a Kevin Harvick is going to be bad fast. Jeff Gordon's going to be bad fast. If I've got to look underneath the surface, I'd probably look at Jamie McMurray. I'm also interested to see, though, you get a guy like Kyle Larson, who's supposed to have all this talent in the world. And he does. He's absolutely wonderfully talented, wonderfully gifted. This is his second season. And are we going to see that Kyle Larson that everybody predicted to be kind of the next Jeff Gordon? That remains to be seen. We'll wait and see on that one. But I don't know. Adam, you got anybody that you're looking at or manufacturers or teams or anything like that?
You led into it perfectly. And honestly, you both mentioned him. He's great at restricted plate races. He's great everywhere. He's an all-time great. And he's about to retire from full-time racing. I really think Jeff Gordon's going to want to come out swinging. I think he's going to get it. Everything he's got. I think he wants to make a statement. I really thought he was going to get it done if it weren't for the collision at TMS this past season. So he's my real pick. He's who I have my eye on.
Yeah.
Josh?
I think Harvick is kind of entering that kind of willpower phase of his career. He does for his championship, and I think the best is still yet to come for Harvick, and I know you guys kind of bagged on Kyle Larson there, but I think Larson, had it not been for the chase, Larson would have finished seventh in the standings because he got so hot at the end of the year. So, but yeah, I mean, restrictor plate racing is always an unknown, but I mean, I wouldn't bet against Kevin Harvick to win. Plus, Kevin Harvick wins, we get a free Bloomin' Onion at Outback Steakhouse. So that's always something that you're cheer for.
You know, I'll tell you this, a guy that we're not talking about, and we've talked a hell of a lot about his team, but Tony Stewart didn't win last year. And this guy has come really close to Daytona so many times as far as getting victory in the biggest race. I mean, you know, he's won here in the July race, and that's all fine and dandy, but let's be honest. That's just, I mean, it's a nice trophy, but it's not what you want when you go to Daytona. So, you know, I got to say, you know, I said something about looking underneath the surface, and all y'all are mentioning Kurt Busch, who, you know, we'll see what happens with him in the next week or so. But, you know, and obviously Danica's quick at reciprocate racing. It's not very hard when you don't have to hit the brake. But, you know, we'll, you know, and obviously Harvick's always that fast, but we keep forgetting about the guy that still owns that thing, and that's Tony. So I actually would not be shocked one bit. And if there's a guy who has emulated anybody that's even close to what Earnhardt had in the sport, it would probably be Tony Stewart. I understand Brett Keselowski's ruffling feathers and upsetting people, and everybody's trying to compare him and, that you know, Earnhardt and whatnot. If you look at a guy like Stewart, who's got that rough-edged attitude, he's not afraid to put the bumper to you, and as he said, he'll whoop your ass. And, you know, as he's told Joey Logano a couple of times, but he's a series champion. He's had no luck at Daytona. When it comes to finally actually getting this 500, he's definitely someone I could see.
I will jump on that bandwagon completely.
You a Seahawks fan?
No.
Okay.
No, I'm not that kind of a bandwagon. Brad Keselowski is a punk-ass kid next to Tony Stewart. Tony Stewart, to me, is a modern-day A.J. Foyt.
Well, he is a champion. You know.
Yeah, he's an IndyCar champion,
no, but I'm referring to, you know, you're calling Brad Keselowski a punk-ass kid.
Well, compared to Tony Stewart. Tony Stewart's a legend already in his own time. And he just publicly came out and said he may not ever race a sprint car again. So I think it'd be a great return to form for a guy who had such a horrible year last year, very much in the public eye, to come back and win right out of the gate at Daytona. What do you guys think?
Would that be probably the best feel-good win of any potentially? I mean, I know the year just started, but I mean, you could almost call it like that's a wrap. We already know feel-good win.
Oh yeah,
best story of the year kind of thing.
I think that'd easily be the feel-good story of the year. My feel-good race in the past couple years has been a go-to where Tony Kanaan finally got his Indy 500. But for Smoke to come out and win Daytona, I think that would absolutely be a feel-good race in 2015, and it would really kick off the whole racing year in perfect style. It's honestly what I hope to see now that we've thought about it and brought it up. All right, we've got just a couple minutes left to go, give or take two. We'll go with some final thoughts. I'll kick it off first. Go Smoke. Happy everything is getting started. Really can't wait to see the IndyCar Aero kit. Really can't wait to see what F1 does. Hopefully someone can take on Mercedes. And really excited for sports car racing. It's always evolving. And really curious to see what that Nissan can do. Josh?
Yeah, I mean the off season it's been long for all of us. I mean, but yeah, we'll be looking forward to getting back in the full swing of things. You know, hoping to be at Santee. We'll be at Long Beach definitely for my first race. But you know, I mean with it getting off with NASCAR, I mean, I like I said, you know, don't bet against Harvick, and we'll see how all this drama in IndyCar. In IndyCar shakes out. I mean, whether or not, you know, not to beat the Brian Barnhart dead horse even more, but you know, I mean, essentially what people have said, you know, don't blame the dog for the owner's bad judgment. So we'll kind of slow. Yeah. So Chris,
I'm looking forward to seeing what we're gonna do. In St. Petersburg, although I'm also hoping that I get to Austin for the Pro World Challenge season opener. since Adam had his public service announcement, I'll make my own. Vaccinate your kids. Joey, what's your next? What's your last words?
Yeah. First off, even though racing is back with Daytona and Speed Weeks and Rolex 24, I gotta say that it's still a tease because the only thing that's on for this month is NASCAR, and the World Superbike Championship kicks off today, the Daytona 500. For the folks that don't know that date, it's February 22nd. And I got to wait till Sebring to watch, or wait till March to watch Sebring. I got to wait to watch Indy at the end of March. And then you got F1 that starts in March. So it tisses a tee. But at least we got the 500. Let me know, you know, we got some good stuff rolling in. But as always, Forza Jules, thinking about you. And, you know, on behalf of Christopher DeHardy, on behalf of Josh Farmer, Adam Tate, I am Joey Barnes. We appreciate you for joining us in the Gravel Trap, and we look forward to bringing it back to you next week. Have a good night, folks.